Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to our Round 4 weekly review show for the 2024 Guinness Men's Six Aces Championship here on the KLNS Rugby Podcast. After a penultimate weekend divided by agony and ecstasy, and that's just on Saturday, we will try and piece together where the teams went right and went wrong. Rejoin us tonight, we have two returnees, one of which is an late impact sub, a bomb squad specialist, if you will, in the form of David Cordiel. And of course, our favourite Welsh guest in Yeston Thomas, who is back as well. Our favourite Ospreys fan, I should have said, not Welsh guest, because the rest of them will kill me. But welcome back, lads. Good to have you back on.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you very much. I'll happily take the tag of best Welsh guest. And to all Welsh journalists and everyone surrounding, happy Wooden Spoon Week as well.
Starting the optimism off on a great start there, yes. But we will start in Twickenham, unfortunately, which is where the optimism dies once more. Just like old times, a Grand Slam favourite denied in a matchup between Ireland and England, but this time it doesn't feel as good because it was Marcus Smith and England who dropped Ireland to a defeat, 23-22 in Twickenham. A gut-wrenching classic, it should be said. But David, it's not to be consecutive slams for Ireland after England kind of resolutely cut them down. Just get the ball rolling here. What's your thoughts on this defeat for Ireland?
I think, God, it was tough. It was really tough. I appreciate you taking advantage of my maskism to get me on for this one. But I mean, look, at the end of the day, slams are hard. Back-to-back slams are even harder. So I think we were, some of us, myself basically, was a bit putting the cart before the horse in expecting things to pan out smoothly. I think the biggest thing after that match for Ireland is that in terms of the fairness of the result, we can have no complaints. Like Andy Farrell said afterwards that it would have been unjust if Ireland had won it. We really didn't deserve it. It was a mixture of England playing possibly their best game. I think some of the pundits over there were saying since 2019, and Ireland just having a complete off day where it seemed like nothing went our way. It was almost unrecognisable from the team of the first three rounds. I think I said in the preview that for England to win, they would need to prevent us from playing the way we wanted to play. And that's pretty much exactly what they did. And they targeted the line out, they targeted our rooks to slow down our speed. And they did something that basically any time it's been deployed against Ireland teams, it has worked in that they deployed a vicious blitz defense. I think particularly in that first 20 minutes, the ferocity, even through the television, of the English defense was just something to behold. And it meant that Ireland were never able to get a grip on the game. We fought back, you know, it has to be said, we only lost by a point in the end. We scored two lovely tries through James Lowe and the game was in the balance. But I think at the end of the day, with two penalty advantages and a drop goal right in front, that was about as fair a result as we were going to get out of that fixture.
Yeah, unfortunately, that there is that element. And I've been criticised a few times for being overly harsh in this Irish team. And I don't think it's that. I'm not saying, well, I'm right and you're wrong. It's not that everyone's entitled to their own opinion on it, but there is a sense of disappointment in this game and disappointed in the players more than in the result, in the fact that like this had so many replicable moments to the quarterfinal. And you are left thinking, lads, you have to start learning. And like, this isn't like just kick them when they're down, because I do believe they'll beat Scotland. I do believe they'll win championship, and I will enjoy it. And I'm hoping to get to go. I'm waiting on the hopefully getting a ticket, and I'd love to be there. But you do feel like, lads, you've let a huge opportunity slip in the same way you did in the quarterfinal. And like, I know people will say, well, you can't be a great team if you don't get to a semi-final or blah blah blah. It just feels like this was your chance to make history, which Andy Farrell is all about. We know that he'll praise England. He'll be the bigger man. Peter O'Mahony, I thought, conduct himself very well in the interview. But for O'Mahony, Tadhg Byrne, Tadhg Furlong, Cailin Doris, I'm trying to think of someone else, James Lowe. Like, these lads are world-class players who are having mixed tournaments amongst them, but just didn't leave a huge impact on the game. And that's the disappointing part, because you can't die wondering, and to their credit, as you said, they fought back. They fought back gallantly. It was there for them. I think it's a weird one. I think if, like, we get a proper hold on, was it Fairbank at that last carry that they made huge guards, and we hold them up, that's it. It's over. But that's but the second fairway also makes that break. It also felt like it was over the other side as well.
A real failure on the night, and this is something that I've seen teams, I've seen Connacht teams in the past, I've seen Italian teams in the past, slip up on this, and it's something that really kills you. We really struggle with our exits. We really struggle to get out of our own half cleanly. And that's something we're usually so good at, particularly through James Lowe. But I thought Murray Kinsella made a good point on, I think it was Ben Earl getting to James Lowe, in that he knew Gibson Park was going to fend. He knew he wasn't going to pass. He knew he wasn't going to kick himself. He was going to pass it to Lowe, and Earl set himself as a sprinter and just pelted at Lowe, to not block him down, but disrupt his kicking. It seemed like this England team, to their credit, knew exactly the way Ireland were going to play, and built a game plan to neutralize each of those strengths at source. And I mean, in that way, it's a testament to this Ireland team that they warranted that level of analysis and that level of counter programming. I think it's also maybe not a stretch to say, when you looked at All Black teams of the past, for you to beat them, they had to have a bad day and you had to have a really good day. And I think if we want to take any positives out of this, it's that it took England having a very good day and Ireland having a bad one for England to get a 1 point win in Twickenham. This is still a very good Ireland team, and I agree with you. I do think they will beat Scotland, partially because it's at home, partially because we've had their measure for the last few years, but I think partially because these guys are not going to take this lying down. They're not going to do this 2 weeks in a row. I would expect Andy Farrell to stick largely with the same team, possibly with a few changes due to injuries. But I think it's going to be it'll be a great game, because it'll be a Scotland hunting for a first triple crown in quite some time. And Ireland not only looking for a championship, but looking for a redemption for what was going to be a day that they will remember for a long time as a massive missed opportunity.
I think you've summed it up wonderfully there. Like, there is layers to it, and it's not finger pointing, and it's not just giving out for the sake of giving out type of, negative chat just for the sake of negativity. They will be disappointed, but they will have to be hard on themselves. I think they kind of have to be, insofar as you look at, okay, some of the pre-match talk was too far, but we did kind of all have the consensus that Ireland would have to play down if they were to lose this game. And I did make the point on the preview podcast that a lot of our conversation was similar to the quarter final, where, okay, if Ireland gets stopped, they're still going to have to not play as well. It's going to come from not finding a way out. And it is kind of the old phrase of, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. Ireland had a plan until England shut them down at source. They put Gibson Park under pressure. Like, fair enough, Ben Earl shooting out the line to try and charge down James Lowe. Some of the passes back to James Lowe weren't perfect. Joe McCarthy made four carries for something like 6 meters, which is the last thing you need from your power lock. Like, it's literally the last thing. Peter O'Mahony did not have a good game by his standards. I don't think he's in great form since the World Cup. That happens. Ryan Baird and Jack Cohen then come in. They didn't have great performances by their standards. So, like, these things happen. These things have to be looked at and worked on. And I think they will. And as you said as well, I would not be making wholesale changes. Do you know, I would be keeping it pretty much the same. See how Calvin is, see how Kieran Frawley is, and go from there. And that's the height of it, to be honest. But
They'll both have to go through return to
HIA
play.
protocols, yeah. I think the fact that we haven't heard anything now, you'd usually say, oh, that's a sign of X or Y, but I don't think it's that. I think it's the fact it's the last week. And one of the bugbears of mine is Ireland don't call up people to the training squad too often, even if I don't personally agree with it a lot of the time. And I think that's just all it is they're just going to give them every chance, and they're not going to just come out and say, oh, such players out, because they know at this stage. It HIA2 is the big one, which is 48 hours or 24 hours afterwards, one or the other. And like, that's the big one that decides whether you're going to play or not. So anyways, we will get Yeston's opinion, because we like having an outside perspective on these things. And again, maybe it's a good thing that we've a Welshman on to get an outside perspective, as you said, wooden spoon week. But yes, I want to ask you, first of all, where do you think it went wrong for Ireland? But also on the flip side of that, where do you think England got it right?
I think it was just mainly down to the pressure that England, gave, and especially in defence. At the start of the tournament, everyone's questioning how long it's going to take this English defence to really click under Felix Jones. Obviously, a completely new system with blitzing out, and you can see that it slowly is starting to work and work well. There was obviously the odd moment at the start of the tournament against Italy where it didn't go to plan, and maybe against Wales it might not have clicked, and Wales tried to do some chip kicks and things like that. But you kind of see it that they kind of set out what they wanted to do to play against Ireland, and they stuck to it for the entire 80 minutes. There was a lot of talk during Calcutta Cup week about Freddie Stewart not being involved in the starting squad and George Fairbairn coming in. And okay, Fairbank didn't have his best of days in Murrayfield on that particular Saturday afternoon, but I thought he played well on the weekend, and you can kind of see why Borthwick made that change in a way. And that's nothing against Freddie Stewart, who I think is a really, really good rugby player. And they just attacked kind of smartly as well. There was nothing majorly flashy of them, but when the opportunity came, they did take it. And I thought Ford had All right, Ford didn't have the best of days off the kicking tee, but I thought he did a really good job in the attack in terms of just orchestrating that team around. And when you got someone like Mara Tosi up front, who I thought had a quietly good game as well, and someone like Ben Earl, as you mentioned about his sprinting towards the James Lowe exit kicks. But I think for Ireland, they just couldn't really get anything going. And maybe that might have been part down to the blitz defence that England were imposing on them. But I think one stat I saw, which saw these one of the second rows that had made more passes than one of the centres. Would you think?
Yeah, I think that was the case. I didn't see it, but I've seen something alluding to the centres and passing, right?
And you're thinking, Bundiaki. And players like that who are normally so good, and who normally get themselves involved and stuck in, even when maybe things might not be going to plan, but just felt like they weren't getting not as much stuck in, but they just couldn't get themselves involved in a way due to the English defence. And have to give a bit of credit to Jemison Gibson-Park. Fair play to him to step out on that wing. And I thought he was really good in the final 20 or so minutes when he was out there. But I think there was a hint of game management which kind of fell away from Ireland as well. It's a
Small, a
bit
small bit.
is a bit contagious, especially nowadays in rugby. When do you like stop kicking and stick it up the jumper and try and play and close out the last remaining minutes of a game? Murray kicked put a box kick in at about 2 minutes to go, and you're thinking that's borderline close in between the timings you need. If it's a minute to go, you probably just about have enough to stick it up the jumper and see it out, barring any penalty decisions. But if it's a bit longer than that, you kind of think, well, like you can see why they're kicking to avoid staying in the particular area of the field, but you have to make sure the kick is pinpoint and 100% accurate, and the chase is there as well. And I felt like that might have been the issue that Ireland had on the weekend.
Yeah, no, it caused a lot of debate. I think the kick decision was right. I've no problem with that. He, the moment, fair enough, people might have a slight overreaction, but I think the decision was right. I think the bigger issue was in the next ensuing two phases, we basically have England back to where we kicked the ball from. And like, you can't let that happen in two phases. After, like, I think it was like a 35-meter clearance kick to touch from a box kick. Like, that's as good as you're going to ask, especially on that short side. If the ball is on the far side of the field, we probably give it to James Lowe and he probably thumps it down. And, you know, if Kieran Frawley's still on the field, maybe he gets back there and takes on the responsibility. Because, like, to his credit, Jack Crowley isn't the biggest boot of a ball, very accurate, not the biggest kicker of a ball. And it's just, as you said, there's kind of fallen between two stools about it because, like, you can't for 2 minutes hold on to that ball when you're losing collisions because you're either going to get pinned for stealing off, someone's going to come in for the side. Or England are going to win a turnover. And if you do hold on for 2 minutes, then you've deserved it, but it's so hard, especially when you're trying to not play and not make yards. So it is an awkward one. And I don't know. I just you mentioned Ashley Gibson Park, and I should probably touch on that. Post game, I was quite critical of him. Watching it back, I think he did all right. There were mistakes. There were certainly mistakes. And I've said this is kind of part of what you get with him. Kind of like Dupont and his solo runs and things like that when they go wrong. Like, you kind of just have to take it for what it is, but he did play well. He was one I was pretty happy with the midfield from 9 to 13. Bundy, he kind of reminds me of an NFL running back in that game, the fact that he got every last inch out of it, every last inch out of every last carry that he had, but he was running up blind alleys, and that was a major issue. And if I think, to his credit, or to Jack Crowley's credit, even, if it wasn't him at 10, I think it could have been worse for Ireland because the ability to problem solve while at the point of attack in the gain line is probably where he has a huge point of difference over all the other 10s. And it certainly made a difference for the second James Lowe try. But we'll move on to next weekend because, I'm conscious of not being too doom and gloom because that's exactly why we bring on David. So we're not too doom and gloom because he's always happy. And David, I'll come back to you because there is a championship to fight for next weekend. There is a championship to be won next weekend. I said it in a tweet over the weekend. I think that's the bare minimum now. I think that was always the bare minimum once they beat France, or once they came into the championship. The minimum was you have to at least be fighting for a championship on the last day, and we are. And it's there for them. It's advantage Ireland. How important is it in your eyes that they get a proper bounce back in Dublin on Saturday?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, it's, you know, the thing is, Ireland had such a good start to this tournament because we went away to France. It was in Marseille, very difficult to win over there. In if you go back to 2020, we had a great championship that year, but it was that match that away game to France that was kind of the decider. And I think going into that game, none of us fully appreciated just how psychically scarred France still were from that World Cup. You talk about Ireland having a tough time at quarterfinals, but for France, this is something they've been planning since they got to host the tournament. A lot of players would have been marking this out as kind of the seminal point in their careers, and I don't think they've adequately dealt with it, and that definitely helped Ireland. So I think once we got over that hump, it seemed like, well, we have to go from here now. There's obviously, we have England away, and that went as badly as you would imagine it could have. But once we crossed that barrier, it felt like, I agree, the championship was the minimum. And I think particularly because, not to do down any of the other teams in the tournament, particularly not teams from which we have representatives on the podcast today, but beating, that's a very young Welsh side. They had to come to Dublin to do an almost impossible task. Italy have played very well this year, but at the same time, once again in Dublin against an Ireland team that was just off the back of a big win in France, those were good victories. But if we don't bookend this with a win against Scotland, this whole tournament takes on a completely different look. We beat a France team that are at sixes and sevens and don't really know where they're at. We beat an Italian team, yeah, a very good Italian team, but we did beat them in Dublin, and we beat a very, very green Welsh team. So if we can't get the, I know I fully back the lads to do it, but if we can't get a win this weekend, this tournament will have very quickly, like in the span of 2 weeks, have gone from an incredible backup of the 2023 form to a real questioning of the big game players, you know, the people like Caelan Dorst, the people like Bundyaki, the people like I wouldn't say Crowley because he's obviously quite new and he's gone quite well, but people like James Lowe, people like Tadhg Burn, you know, the really big players in the team, Peter Omani, we need to back it up next week. We not just for the championship, but for the sake of the momentum of this team. If we can't back it up at home against Scotland, it'll really, really bring into question whether or not we're capable of dealing with high stress, high pressure situations. That being said, not to be doom and gloom, I do think we will do it. I don't know how clean it'll be, but I would fully back Ireland at home with a lot on the line, but with, I would imagine, a fully sold out crowd behind them. I really can't see a way that this will go other than Danny and Ireland's favour. I do think Scotland will show up for it, as I think I said to you earlier. They're chasing a treble crown for the first. It'd be the first time in quite a while, and obviously a big away win. I think they'll be kicking themselves because if they've gotten that win over Italy, you know, there's a championship on. There would have been a championship on the line for them too. But yeah, with that triple crown in mind, and with the idea of, you know, ruining Ireland's time. Ireland have had Scotland's measure over the last few years. They've had the misfortune of being drawn against us in the last two World Cup draws, and those games very much did not go in their favour. If they can get one over on us, I think they'd be absolutely champing at the bit to do that. So I think it'll be an exciting game. Scotland are a team that like to attack. Ireland are a team that like to attack. I think you could see a lot of tries, but I do think in the end, Ireland are going to come out on top.
And again, it's just they have to. Like, I don't care if it's
They really
9-3.
have to.
They do. And like this, even the South African tour takes an entirely different light if they don't, because then you've gone into the Six Nations doubling down and trying to win it, which essentially only two teams did.
I mean,
May, may, maybe three.
only a week ago, we had Sam Warburton saying he still thinks Ireland are the best team in the world. Now, that might have been done just to annoy the South Africans, but you know, in 2 weeks, that's a massive sea change to go from possible first back-to-back Grand Slams, and on our way to challenge the world champions in their backyard. To, I mean, if we don't beat Scotland, it will be slinking out of the tournament with our tail between our legs, and I don't think that's a thing that this team is going to leave up to chance.
And they just can't. Like, it's as simple as that. They just can't. Or those serious questions should be asked. Serious questions that probably could have been asked last November if it was anyone other than New Zealand. Do you know? And like, there is that factor that's like, well, it's New Zealand. Like, there's always a chance they'll figure it out, and they did. And like, that's kind of the prism which view it from. But we are, what, like 20 minutes into this show, so I should move on, because uplifting. Picture the sunshine, picture of Rome, a packed out Stadio Olimpico, because Gonzalo Caceres' men overturned a 12-point deficit to beat Scotland for the first time since 2015, their first home victory since 2013 in the Six Nations, which was actually against us, coincidentally. After the agony of Lille, it was sheer joy. Paolo Gavisi, the hero. Yeston, what a win for Italy. What a statement performance, and literally no more than they deserved.
Well, first of all, I did have a little bit of a fright when I saw Gabisi, well, I saw the ball fall off Gabisi's tee at the first penalty. I thought, oh no, not again. But he kicked it, which is good. And then all of a sudden, Scotland just came into this game from out of nowhere and scored a couple of really nice tries. And you just hope that the Italian heads didn't drop, 22-10 down. You're thinking, if Scotland get another score, it's going to be a long way to come back into it. But full credit to Italy coming back into it the way they did. Just making sure that the scoreboard was ticking along, and with Pedrillo and Gabisi, they had two fine kickers who could do that, and they seem to have identified a good weakness in the Scottish backline, especially through kicking, as we saw with the first try with Ignacio Bress scoring. Kinghorn at fullback has gone to cover the wing, and it leaves poor Horn trying to cover the entirety of the backfield. And it was a neat set play from the Italians, and Bress scores from it. And then obviously the Louis Leiner try in the second half is another kick. So it's surely there was something that the Italians looked at. And probably the most pleasing thing was it was a win at home against a side that didn't really rest many players. You know, you probably got used to over the last few years, you know, teams playing Italy and maybe resting the odd player here and there. But certainly over the last couple of years or so, okay, we'll exclude the World Cup, the last World Cup last year. But over the last couple of years, you know, there's definitely been improvements in this Italian side. You know, 2 years ago they went in Cardiff, you know, and you just felt like they just need another win just to get back onto that train, especially after a poor World Cup. They were ridiculously close last week in France, and they probably fully deserved it this weekend in Rome. And you know, full credit to them and Caicedo's head coach. He seems like a really smart appointment. And you know, they've still got a relatively young squad. You know, Garbisi's been around the block for a good number of years, about for 4 years. And you know, they're still growing by every game. And you know, I mentioned Brex, and I got to give a bit of a mention to Tommaso Menoncello, because I think he has probably been one of the stars of the tournament, and a well-deserved victory for the Italians.
Absolutely. Menoncello and Brex in particular were phenomenal. It's probably as good of a center pairing performance that we've seen in the tournament so far. And it kind of ties in on my point, the next point I was going to make, David, because we knew if Italy were to win this, and it was always kind of an if, it was going to go down to the wire, and it did. But because of that, you have to give them so much credit for that incredible last gasp defensive stand. Like Michele Lamro made something like, was it 29 tackles or something on Saturday? He definitely had a few in that passage. The two, Lorenzo Cannone had a couple of tackles in that passage. Giuliani, I'm pretty sure, did. The centres, as we said, Menoncello and Brex. Like, talk about coming up clutch when needed for a team who hasn't been there, who hasn't done it. Yes, they bet Wales, but apart from that, it's been meagre for the last couple of years. They needed to be gutsy. They needed to be confident. No penalties allowed. No space for a drop goal, ends in a knock on. Like, it's in some ways, it is the perfect way for Italy to win that game because it's exactly what we've criticized them for.
Yeah, no, it was the thing about this game was from an Italian perspective, was it was a very complete performance. Italy have shown that they're capable of scintillating attack in the past, but the kind of consistency you need to win a test match like that, the kind of defensive metal you need, has been something that has been lacking them, and it's something that they've struggled with at club level as well. You know, notably, I mean, you know, I'm a big Zebre fan, and Zebre similarly, very good attacking team, can't defend for their lives, and so it always ends up costing them games, because if you can't stop the other team scoring tries, you're going to end up in a shooting match, and if they have any kind of defense at all, you're not going to be able to outscore them. This Italian performance was complete, and I think the best thing for Italy out of this game is that they've had upset wins before. You know, they've gotten wins against big teams. Interesting little factor. I think there's only three teams that they've ever played against that they've lost against without beating. Two of them are New Zealand and England. The other is the Cook Islands. Fun fact for you. But
There's
it's
the fact we all needed on
there's
this
a fun fact.
dreary Monday evening.
But the thing about this win for Italy is that it wasn't an upset. It didn't feel like they'd blitz Scotland or that they'd taken them by surprise. This was a genuine, honest to God, competitive test match, and they came out on top against another serious side, you know, a side that had just come, you know, beat England.
Hang on now. I think that's might be one of the issues we're going to talk about on Scotland. Are they serious?
I think in the Six Nations they are. I think in the last few years, you know,
Are
obviously
they?
Ireland have had their measure, but they've started to put consistency together. You know, that they've definitely had England's number for years. They've been consistently finishing, you know, top three or four. So I do think certainly when compared to Italy's win record, this is a serious competitive win fixture, and they won, and they did it after an excellent performance against France, where they probably should have won. And I think that's one thing. I think Quesada himself said it, is that Italy have struggled to back up. They've struggled to follow one strong performance with another one, and now they've done that. Obviously, it didn't go their way in Ireland, but they came very close to. They were like right on England's tail. They had a bit of an off patch in the second half in that game, where it got away from them. If they could have stamped that out, they genuinely could have had a chance against England there. They should have beaten France. They have now gotten the win over Scotland, and they're going to be going to it's in Cardiff next week, isn't it? They're going to go to Cardiff with a serious hope of a serious possibility of getting another win there. And saying it to our mutual friend Theo, they could come out of this tournament having a realistic chance of 4 out of 5 wins. And that's incredible. Like even if they come out with 2 wins and a draw, for a team that, only a few years ago people were questioning their place in the Six Nations, this is a huge step up. And it's like I said, they're not upsets. These are genuine wins where you can see they have good patches, they have bad patches, but they put a whole 80-minute performance together and they get the win in the end. And it's players like you said, Ignacio Brex and Menichello were phenomenal. Menichello is only 21. This is a young Italian team, and if you look down further down the tracks at their under-20s teams and how they've been performing over the years, I think there's a real chance that Italian rugby is going to start to become a much stronger force in the Six Nations, possibly even a much stronger force in world rugby. And I think after years of slogging it out, of carrying that wooden spoon, it would be a great sign of a real growth of what is still quite a minority sport into something that could become much bigger. I had a friend who I worked with who's a Sicilian, never followed rugby at all, very much a devout soccer man, but I tried to get into it in the last World Cup, and he texted me immediately after that game, absolutely ecstatic. It's if we can get people like that, people who had no interest in rugby, suddenly interested in it because they have a team that realistically has a shot at winning. I think that's the greater, bigger story. But on the smaller story level, on the just the day that's in it level, this was a fantastic win for Italy, and it was a great reward for their fans for selling out Stadio Olimpico for the first time in I don't know how long. And if they can back it up next week, we talked about how if Ireland can't back it up next week, it'll really change the temper of their tournament. But if Italy can back it up next week against Wales, it's going to go down as one of their, if not their best tournaments since the start of the Six Nations.
No, and I do agree. And I should add, when I put in the line about Scotland, it was not questioning whether this counts as a big win for Italy. It does. It is huge. The fact that it came at home, I think, is massive. I think that's so much bigger than just winning the game, because they hadn't won a home in 11 years in the Six Nations. Yes, they won in Cardiff, and that was very, very important for them 2 years ago in the stepping stone. But to do it at home, the eruption, the passion, the emotion. Like when they have their November test there this year, there's going to be an added buzz, and that's kind of the feed on point. But to go back to Italy, because I do want, we'll talk about Scotland next during the week, because we'll have a preview of the Ireland Scotland games. We'll get to talk about them. We'll talk about them in a minute as well. Like, so many players stood up, but it's players who are going to have to start learning the names of as well. Like Nicolò Cannone, I mentioned it. I text someone who during the game, I was like, he's everywhere. He's just been everywhere. Now, the fact that himself and Lorenzo look fairly similar, similar size, similar build, there's that side of things as well. But they were phenomenal. I think Federico Ruzza has had an amazing tournament. Lamro, who was mentioned, he's the top tackler in the tournament, I'm pretty sure. Or if not, he's right up there. I think Pajarello has completely changed their attack. No disrespect to Stephen Varney, but he's a finicky kind of nine. He does make mistakes and he probably doesn't back it up. Pajarello has been phenomenal. Garbisi has been good. Haven't had, a lot thrown at him, including ourselves. Like, we doubted him on this podcast earlier on in the tournament, but he's bounced back. Two centres we mentioned. And Tuca Poutsou had a very assured game, which is probably something that, again, we kind of doubted him because he's had his moments, but he's not had the run of games to mature at the level that Italy would probably want him to have. But he has matured. Monte Ioane, he carries with purpose. He kind of carries the team a small bit. Like, he's kind of like, he's almost like your big power forward, in the fact that when he gets go forward, the team gets go forward properly. And it's huge. It's huge for Italy. And the fact that this is the first time, 4 rounds in the 3 weeks they didn't play Ireland, they were last on the billing on this podcast. I'm sure we're not the only one to have bumped them up, because it's the big storyline. It's the one they ever want to talk about. And listen, I don't know about you. I was in the pub on Saturday, and we all jumped up out of our seats when that ball was knocked on. And that's not just because I'm a Munster fan who doesn't like Glasgow. It's not that at all. But like, it's a huge moment. It's great to see. But yes, I want to ask you about Scotland. Because they came into this game as genuine title contenders, and like, yeah, England did them a favor. They still have the slightest of chances. They could still win a triple crown, as David said. But this is just such a misstep. Like, how are we supposed to take this team seriously when they don't show up in the World Cup against South Africa? They definitely don't show up against Ireland. They had three tries scored against Wales, couldn't get a fourth. Three tries scored against England, couldn't get a fourth. Three tries scored after 25 minutes here in this game, couldn't get a or two. Sorry, three tries scored after 25 minutes, couldn't get a fourth to see off the game. Do get a fourth when the game looks lost. Like, there has to be questions asked of Scotland at this stage, surely.
Well, I think there is, but before I go on about Scotland, for anyone that doubts Paolo Garbisio, I have him as my fantasy captain, so I never have. It's been some sort of tradition of mine for my fantasy team that I always stick him in as captain, regardless of form. But yeah, it seems like a bit of a weird patch for Scotland, because if you look at certain parts of their game, you think, oh, they're a really good side, you know. First half against Wales, where they ran into a lead, and obviously Van der Merwe scored that try, giving them a 27-0 lead. The hat trick that Van der Merwe scored against England. You're thinking, oh, right, Scotland might be onto something here, you know. And then you have these little lapses of just either not concentration. I'm not really sure what it is, but it's quite hard to kind of pinpoint where. It just feels like they have a little spell where it just doesn't really click, and it feels like it goes on longer than what you normally expect it to be as well. Because obviously against Wales, they scored that try in the 42nd minute, and they were under the cosh for the rest of the game. And you're thinking, and you're walking out thinking, oh, if Wales had another score, they'd have won, then probably one of the biggest comebacks in the history of the Six Nations. Okay, the France game is a completely different story for a completely different day, especially with the ending. But, I'm not sure how much that kind of affected them in a way, because, there's similar performance happened in Cardiff before, where they built a lead, then they maybe didn't take a chance or failed to kill off the game, and then they allow the opposition back in, and it's a perfect case of it happening out in Rome on Saturday. You score three tries, and you're thinking, right, when's this bonus point going to come? And when are Italian heads going to drop? But whilst the Italian heads didn't drop, it felt like the Scots did in a way. They thought, all right, well, we're not having it very easy anymore. And it just felt like the Finn Russell was at times just on his own. I think I read a tweet saying that whilst Scotland have lost their heads, Finn Russell hasn't, or words to that effect. And you're thinking, there's something not potentially right there, and it's really hard to pinpoint. And it's a really big week for Gregor Townsend now, having the chance of genuinely winning the championship has now gone. Well, there's still a slight,
Realistically, yeah.
if you're mathematicians out there, but it's just that, how do you lift up that side from, the France game, from the Italy game, failures to take bonus points in the other two, and to go to Dublin, which is a really tough place to go at the end of the day. So it's a big week for Scotland, and it'll be very interesting to see how they turn up on Saturday.
Yeah, it is, and it's. I feel like you could write a book on Scotland just by nature of them. They are the new France. You don't know what's going to turn up, but I'm delighted you mentioned that point about Finn Russell, because I was going to ask David if you hadn't. It does feel like he is the steady Eddie on that team, and it sounds remarkable. You wouldn't have even said this 2 years ago, but it feels like he's the constant. He's the one who's making things work. It's his crossfield kick to, I'm going to say Kyle Steyn, that gets him the spark and gets them ahead. And gets or gets some goal forward in the last minute of the game. Otherwise, they were going nowhere. It did feel like for a lot of that game, he was just shoveling on ball. His Redpath and Hugh Jones, they had sparks, but they didn't do a lot. Blair Kinghorn didn't really do a lot in that second half to kind of push on, force initiative. Felt like Doohan was running up blind alleys as well. And sometimes it is just a case of, well, especially for Finn, he's not a huge ball carrier. He can only do so much. And maybe it's a game plan thing. Maybe it's the pack build. Maybe that's wrong. I thought Andy Christie actually had a good game, but is he the type of player they're going to go for with a big heavy six? Is that the way they're going to go with Darragh as your breakdown threat? I think they kind of have to. I think power is still an issue, even though, yeah, against France, it wasn't too big of a deal. Against England, it wasn't a big deal. Against Wales, it wasn't. But still, you come up against an Italy side who will always punch above their weight, and Scotland just looked small, and like mentally and physically in that second half. And it is serious questions, and you do have to say, like, seen a lot of complaints about Angus Gardner, who was reffing it. I thought, to be honest, neither side can have much complaints, to be honest, because both of them were kind of, he was strict. He just had a very strict day. And listen, ref discourse is not something we like to get into anyway. But Italy roll on. They will play Wales next. We might touch that in a few minutes, but we have one last game of the men's championship to move on to, because Wales took on France in Cardiff. This is our opening game next year, coincidentally, albeit in France. And to be fair, it didn't disappoint for about 60 odd minutes, but the strong Welsh effort was in vain. France were now 45-24 winners, as you may know, and as Yestin alluded to now, it looks like it is wooden spoon week for Wales. They need a mini miracle to avoid it. And Yestin, as our Welshman on the show, I'll start with you. Like, 4 losses from 4 for Gatland's Wales. We thought he stormed out of a press conference. He didn't. He just had other places to be. But like, it doesn't feel like it's a catastrophic failure, but just the nature of this one is just, it feels like it's going to sting. It feels like it's the one game that if they stayed in the fight for 80 minutes, they could have done something, but just ran out of steam.
Yeah, it's probably a tough one to take for any Welsh supporter out there. I think it's kind of been the theme of Wales's tournament in a way. It's quite similar to Scotland, where obviously Scotland might have patches of poor play, but Wales kind of just sometimes maybe fall off in latter stages of matches, or maybe at the start of matches like we saw against Scotland in round one. But it's probably a better pill to swallow. France weren't as France as a France of old, as in from the 2019-23 World Cup cycle. But you just kind of sense that the Welsh side gave it a really good go, but the French bench, they got on top. And at the end of the day, it's with the power up front, you got the likes of Antonio. Miafu, the second row on debut, looks big, and yeah, they just slowly got their way forward, and they took control and won the match. Gregor Aldrich being back was a huge bonus for them, and so I think with an Antoine Dupont, who might not be here, obviously you're playing sevens. His role's been nicely filled by a certain Mr. Legarec, who seems like a really good French scrum half, in his first Six Nations start. He had a good game as it was, and to pull that reverse pass out from seemingly nowhere was pretty exceptional. But it's probably not a dig on Wales either. There were some really encouraging performances. Okay, there was the odd mistake, but both centres went well. There was a lot of talk about that in the week. George North and Nick Tompkins being dropped, but Owen Watkin came in and played rather well, probably one of his best games for Wales, at 12. And Joe Roberts, in his first Six Nations start, gets a try. Although, if he didn't score, there would be a lot of discussion about that, as he should have cast that out. But, you've got the likes of Raffle, Thomas Williams, who have played well throughout the tournament. And, in the first half, I thought the three second rows, so obviously Dav Jenkins moved to six, and Adam Beard and Will Rowlands together, I thought they all worked rather well, despite what the French scrum were doing. But it feels like it's quite hard to pinpoint it on the players. Okay, some tactical and substitution calls, people have disagreed with online, because with Thomas Williams and Costello having an okay game. But it feels like it's a wooden spoon that the players probably don't deserve, as of course they might beat Italy and avoid it. But if it is the case, it doesn't feel like the players they probably don't deserve this. It's probably down to the decade or so where the governing body, the WIU, have been an utter mess from top to bottom, especially with their ways of their work with the professional clubs. And it's probably one on them, not on the players and coaches.
No, I get that. I might just touch on a point you made there, because you touched on Thomas Williams and Sam Costello. Personally, I think They've had a good championship, not perfect, don't get me wrong, like it hasn't all went their way at half back for Wales. What have you made of them overall and in terms of just looking forward at Costello in particular, because there's been a lot of talk about him. A lot of it is unfair. It is his first championship. What have you made for of it?
Yeah, it's you're always going to get people that come out and say, oh, so and so should be dropped because he's not very good and things like that. But, and I'm going to use a Toby Booth line here, fly halves especially need time in the saddle, don't they? And, more game time you get at 10, the better for any young player out there. You've seen with Jack Crowley in Ireland, who's obviously probably got a little bit more experience than Costello in terms of URC matches and playing in big games. So it kind of made his step up to the test level a little bit easier in a way. But it's tough on Costello because, these high pressure environments and things like that, these big games, these big European knockouts or URC knockouts, you kind of get prepared for the next step up in a way. And obviously with the way that the Welsh rugby is currently being run, the four professional clubs aren't really getting that sort of luxury of getting to the last stages of Europe and things like that. When you saw when Cardiff played Toulouse in December, the Toulouse side was stacked with basically a test team at the end of the day. DuPont was playing, Ramos was playing and things like that. But these Welsh players at the minute, the youngsters that are coming through into the regional setups who have, like I said, been underfunded for a long period of time, it's just that they don't have games where they can close it out and see it out. And maybe if they're a point or two down, they get that final score to get them over the line. And I think it's probably the accuracy was probably the difference between Costello and Ramos, obviously the French outside half. One example where Costello, puts a really neat kick in behind the French defence, but sadly it travelled a little bit too long and it bounces, well, it goes out on the full. And then Ramos, a couple of minutes later, puts in a kick in behind the Welsh defensive line and it bounces into touch. And you're thinking, that was, the difference. France had a line out where it was back for the kick. Wales have a defensive line out 5 meters out from their own try line because of Ramos's smart play. And you just felt like, that the experience is the difference. And it's quite similar to what the French players were on debut. You've got the likes of Ligarec, you've got Leo Barry as well on debut. Those players have had a lot of top 14 experience. Barry's been in fine form for Stade Francais throughout the year. And then you look at the Welsh side, there's someone like Cam Winnett, who is a perfectly good player, and has stepped up well this Six Nations, considering his lack of experience. Now, I'm pretty sure the Scotland game was something like his 15th or 16th professional game of rugby in his career, where you've got, some players who might not have got into the test squad until now, who've had a handful of, loads of club games and European matches to their boot, and Winnett's only just starting off at the club level, let alone stepping up into the test match level. So it was always going to be, pretty tough, but yeah, it's hope more than anything that they can, build on some aspects of this Six Nations. But Costello, it's an interesting one because if you take him out, who's there to come in to fill that void? Dan Biggar's retired. As much as it pains most Welsh supporters nowadays, he is in fact retired from international rugby. Gareth Anscombe is out injured. There's still a bit of talk of him coming back into the fold with Gloucester next season. So it's a tough one for Costello. He's probably learning the hard way a little bit, going out to Dublin, well, he didn't play against England, but facing these big sides, and you're not going to get much momentum up front, and it was always going to be tough. But it's just about gaining that development and experience, and hopefully, going back to the club game and then hopefully getting closer results, and then hopefully that will feed up back into the national side.
Absolutely. David, we have touched on France as well because they did win this game. I know yesterday earlier mentioned Nolan Legarec, who was phenomenal player of the match on the day. Do you think I feel like this is just too much of a roller coaster question, but do you think are they back or is it just the upside of the swing?
I don't know if it's if we've gone far enough to say that they're back yet. I think we've really well. I think to touch on Nolan Legarek, I mentioned this to somebody when I was watching the game, even in the first half when they were still behind. It really kind of seemed from early on that Legarek was who they should have had at nine all along. Nothing against Maxime Lucu. Obviously, he had the partnership with Jalibert, but Legarek just seemed like the kind of energy they needed in that space. Still frighteningly young, but much more the kind of energy and the kind of game control that DuPont really guided that team with. So I would expect they'll retain him until DuPont gets back. Yeah, I don't know if we can say they're back just yet. I do think that they seem to have grown into the tournament. I think they got blitzed out the gate by Ireland. I think they haven't exercised the demons of the World Cup just yet, but as this tournament goes on and the longer they spend in camp, the more they'll get back into the flow of just playing the matches in front of them rather than replaying the ones behind them. They had the draw against Italy, which probably should have been a loss, but much as with England and Scotland, if you go back and watch France and Italy over the years, even though Italy haven't got wins, they have seemed to be one of the teams, even when France are on form, that are able to get a good performance against France. So I wouldn't even hold that almost loss, that draw against them. I think they're growing into the tournament. I think that week one, which if they had to play any team week one, they probably would have lost. But as the tournament has gone on, they've gotten losses, they've gotten wins. They're just shaking it off now. They're doing what they should have done in the immediate aftermath of the World Cup. I think Ireland sent all of their players on holidays immediately after the World Cup. All of the French lads got right back into the top 14, and I think that's about the worst thing they could have done. Gregory Aldry took off until the new year, and that was probably the smartest thing to do. But I think now with four games under their belts, they're a little bit back. They know what it is to win, they know what it is to lose, and they're getting back into the flow of rugby. And I think a final weekend showdown with England, where technically speaking, both teams can still win the tournament. Although obviously at that point they'll know based on Ireland's result against Scotland, but they could be looking into a game there where both of them theoretically could still win the championship. So I think at home that one will really light a fire under France. The thing with this French team is that it's a quality team. It's across the park. They are a phenomenal outfit. The fact that they weren't playing phenomenal rugby doesn't take away from the quality of the actual players. And I think now that they have Legarec in there, now that they have a bit of impetus, which certainly in that last 20 minutes we saw what they're capable of when they actually set out to play. Gael Fico, I thought, had a brilliant match, and he's a big leader on that team too. So are they back? They're not where they were, but I don't think it's necessarily fair to expect them to ever be there again, because that home World Cup was the kind of top of the mountain target that really only comes around once in a career. But they're definitely, I will say, if we had to play them again next week, I wouldn't be anywhere near as confident, despite how well we went against them in the first week.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that, and I think Bernard Jackman made the point as well. Like, I don't think we fully appreciate just how much resource was put into this France World Cup, like including paying top 14 wages for assistant coaches at national level, which just doesn't usually happen. Do you know, like that's kind of, they had to put a huge financial impetus. They had to get the best coaches. They had to get the best prep. You know, it was all like it's since 2017, essentially. It's a long time now. And it was going to take a bit of time. And to be fair, it's sometimes the guys who don't have the baggage. Like you look at Francois Cros, arguably their player of the tournament. Nolan Legarec, phenomenal. The other day, Louis Bialbiari, who, to his credit, kind of came in and took that shirt, starting shirt at the World Cup. He's still young. And maybe it's just that naivety of youth. He's been one of their best players as well. And there's no real surprise to that. Yesterday, yeah, no, go on, David.
No, I think you actually touched on a really good point there. We made this point a while ago about Ireland, that you had players like Dan Sheehan and Hugo Keenan who didn't know what it was like to lose against the All Blacks, and so it was easier for them to play them. I think, yeah, more younger players like that who don't have the baggage. I mean, Antoine Dupont was so shattered by the loss. He's off playing sevens, which is great, and he's really good at it, unsurprisingly. But,
And he's
you know,
beating Ireland out of 2 weeks in a row.
of course, he has to find a way to ruin the party. But like, you know, you look a year ago in the run-up to that World Cup, he was hanging out with the president, you know, with Emmanuel Macron. Like, this was so big in France's sports. So like, this would have been a defining moment for French sport if they'd won a home World Cup. Like, yeah, I think you're right. You cannot comprehend just how much was put into this endeavor, and for them to bow out in the quarterfinals, no less. I think was a massive psychic blow. So yeah, I think younger players who aren't who didn't carry that, you know, Legarac is in now. He can make this his tournament. You know, the World Cup wasn't his event. He can make this now his event, his championship. So yeah, I think that kind of impetus is exactly the thing. And that's the thing with France. They're 14 proteins, the top 14, not to mention the Pro D2. They have the cattle. You know, they could probably replace their entire squad, their entire 23 next week and still have a phenomenal squad. So yeah, I think a few wouldn't be the worst idea in the world to get a few young lads who weren't in the World Cup and don't have the baggage of that, and take a real good cut off England.
I guarantee the one thing that would have changed, if the only thing that changed over the weekend was the result in the Ireland game, you'd have changed that to sentence too. They could change the whole 23 and still beat England. But unfortunately, we can't say that now after everything that's happened. But
Begrudgingly admit that England are good at rugby.
no, not going to happen. I think Rog was right. I do still think the Premiership is in dire straits. And he has every right to point that out. He has hammered every top Premiership team. But, anyways, that's going off track and going down a tangent. Yes, and I'm going to come back to you for the final question for the senior championship side of things. We like to end looking forward. France welcome England to Lyon. That's at 8 p.m. on Saturday night. Wales take on Italy and Cardiff next as well. That's the early game, the 2:15 game. Both sides need to win. Probably more importantly, both head coaches need to win. From what you have seen, how do you think round five will go in those two games?
I haven't made my mind up in terms of predicting Wales versus Italy yet. So if you can come back about Friday, I'd give you a bit of an answer. Like you just said, Wales do need a win, and they could find themselves in a place where they win and still get the wooden spoon. I think the most important thing for Wales here is they avoid a complete whitewash. You don't want play five, lost five on a Six Nations table, and it's really important that they try and stay in the fight, whatever means, if it's up front or that, using the backs or tactical kick in, just stay in that fight. And who knows? There's but Italy are gonna come here with so much more confidence. Yeah, I even think even if they lost against Scotland on the weekend, they'd still have quite a bit of confidence coming into this game because of what they did 2 years ago. Not many people expected them to come to Cardiff 2 years ago and win, and they came to Cardiff and they won. So, especially off the back of two really good performances and what they did last time in Cardiff, their confidence, should be up, and it's going to be a big task for Wales to try and stop that. So, my heart says Wales, but my head really is thinking a narrow Italian win. So, I'm going to have to call it a draw, but I think it'll probably be prob I'm probably edging towards Italy by about a score, and just I think it's going to be a really good it's going to be a good game, and it's going to be really an exciting game. Both sides probably will attempt to play in some way, shape, or form. And then obviously France England in the night, you just feel like maybe France might have got that back on track. But then if you watched England on the weekend, you're thinking, oh, they might go up to Paris, well, not but to France rather, and be a lot more confident in their game, especially in defence. So I'm not so sure on this one either, but it's a bit early to do predictions on a Monday night, if I'm honest. But yeah, this one's going to be probably a bit of a difference in terms of contrast from Wales. I think it'll be a little bit more tight. I think France might rely on the tactical kicking aspects of things a little bit more, and I think the home advantage might just see them through. But I think it'll be another close match. I think England might just fall short on this one. So Italy by a score and France by a score.
David, I might just get a quick word from you on those two games as well.
Yeah, well, like I said, with France, I think they've been building to this tournament and they've been getting better. I think they'll go with Ligueres again next week. While I do think he's a very good backup to Dupont and probably should have been the nine shirt, I also think they're going to feel the loss of Jalibert. Thomas Ramos is a very good test 15. I don't know if he's a very good test 10, but with Legarek running the show from nine, that might make up for that. I also think there's a possibility that England really peaked last week. Emotionally, you could see how, particularly Ben Earl, I mean, he's one of my now favorite players in the England squad because he got so much stick for the celebrating the knock-ons, and then he turns around and is actually a really good rugby player. But you could see how up for the game lads like him were, and how much they really really went out there to just do a number on Ireland, and now that they pull that off, they have to go away to France next week. I don't know if they'll have the emotional energy to back it up, and I think France now have maybe a point to prove after how some of the other results in this tournament have gone. So I'd say France will edge it with the home advantage, although it wouldn't be beyond England to give them a bit of a scare. When it comes to Italy, Wales, I mean, I'd love to see Italy go down there and back up the performance that they had in Scotland. Like I said, they have struggled to back up performances, but having put the draw that should have been a win against France and back that up with a win against Scotland at home, it'd be great to see them do three in a row. I'll touch on something that actually I think Michaela Lamro himself commented on last year after that great win in Cardiff. In 2022, 2023 comes around and it's a home game, and Italy are really setting up. This is kind of the game they're targeting, and they lost their nerve and they mentally did not prepare. I think they went into that game too focused on, weirdly, it's weird to say, but too focused on winning it rather than on playing it, and it got away from them. And Wales did a job of them. You would hope that after that they will have learned from that experience, and they certainly seem to have. Seem to be a team now that are just able to play without worrying about the too many of the overarching vibes. It definitely would have been something I think Ireland players have said that when you're in the match, it doesn't matter what the predictions are, it doesn't matter what the overall goal is. You have to win the moments, you have to win the collisions. If Italy can do that, I think that they're odds on to win for me, but it'll be narrow. And I think Wales, those young lads have had a hell of a trial by fire in this tournament, but I think there is already some cream rising, and they will be very determined not to be stuck with the wooden spoon, particularly at home. So I'd say it, probably Italy by a score, but man, it'll be a really narrow score.
I tend to agree. I don't like betting against Wales, especially in Cardiff, no matter who they play. Definitely not going to bet against France in Lyon. Like, the ticket applications for that game was like three times the size of the stadium. Like, it's going to be raucous. It's at 8 o'clock at night. It's against England. Like, it's the crunch. They might still have something to play for. Yeah, probably won't. But like, I think at that stage at night, you really don't care. There's that side of it as well.
I don't think the French need to have something to play for when it comes to England. You know, that's
No.
enough.
No, that's it. Like, and 2 years ago when they won the Grand Slam for this game, it was kind of over after half an hour and it was a bit of a party, and they'll embrace it, and I think it'll be a cracking atmosphere. There's only one more game to cover. It's to the Rec in Bath, where under 20s table leaders England took on defending champions Ireland. And boy, did it deliver, unfortunately, in some regards. Too many heart attacks this week. Ireland snatched a late draw with the last kick of the game after a try from Shannon RFC's Luke Murphy. David, I don't get into too much detail in the under-20s on this show, just kind of surface level stuff, but what a game. What a championship it's been this year. Like, every game seems to be a cracker, and I suppose in terms of the on-field action, a draw probably the fair result.
Yeah, I think so. I was watching it back today. I also hadn't anticipated having to talk about this game. I did watch it live, but probably not with enough of a close eye to be commenting on it. So I watched the highlight reel back today, and watching the start of it, I was like, how did we almost lose this game? Because we were playing so well and scoring some great tries. But England at under 20s level and they have been for years, to be fair. Now they've spoiled our party a couple of times over the years at under 20s level. But yeah, it was a hell of a fight. The wreck is a bit of crack in the ground, and the two teams just absolutely went for it. It was probably a fair result in the end to have it end a draw. And as much as we didn't get the win, it did kind of feel like a snatch. As much as it would have been a snatch if the seniors had won. England got that final score, I think, in the 77th minute, and you got a feel for them because you feel you go 7 points ahead with 2 minutes to go. The game is
With a
yours.
touchline to conversion to boot as well. What a kick.
Brilliant stuff. I think Sean Kerr, their kicker, very good off the tee. It's your game to lose at that stage, but for Ireland to really dig back in and get back to the goal line, and it can be so easy to get a bit of whitewash fever, particularly when you're under 20s. These are young guys. It's always important to remember, a lot of these lads are teenagers. They're not professional rugby players. Not all of them will become professional rugby players. For some of them, this will be the defining moment of their rugby careers. And to show them mettle, not to give away penalties, to keep their nerve, and to get that try right on the posts to secure the draw was phenomenal. There were a couple of you're always looking at players as potential. I think the biggest one going into it, and probably one of the biggest one coming out of it, was Hugh Gavin, the big number 12. He's a phenomenal player. You feel he's definitely got a future at Connacht. It's something Connacht seem to go through these cycles. Leinster have an abundance of out halves at the moment. Ulster are renowned for their producing outside backs, but Connacht seem to be just producing centres at a pace. And I think when Gavin gets up to senior level, which I think he will, himself and Colin Ford could make a hell of a pairing. Even if you go back to, of course, Robbie Henshaw, probably one of their greatest products in the centre as well. So I thought Hugh Gavin was a big takeaway from that. Finn Tracy, I didn't know much about him before the game, to be honest, but man, that guy's quick. He's big, he's fast, but he's fast. And his try off that crossfield kick, he still had a man to beat, and he just muscled his way by him and dotted it under down under the sticks. He was phenomenal. And I thought Ed Murphy, is it Jack Murphy? Is that his first name? Jack?
Jack is the out half. Luke is number 8.
Yeah, Jack Murphy, the young number 10. I think he's Richie's son, isn't he? Watching the game back, he kicked well, but one thing I thought Ireland did a really good job of drawing England's defence in narrow, really condensing that defensive spread, and then one pass out to Murphy at 10, and he was whipping these big long passes left and right, and the wingers were just sauntering in. And I thought that kind of passing from some of that young in both directions was pretty impressive. Once again, there's a long list of players coming out at Leinster. Wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if you saw him go to another province potentially, but I thought he really, as a number 10, controlled the game well, and I think he had at least two, if not three, try assists directly off of his big long loping passes. So I thought, as a standout, he was pretty good.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I was going to touch on the players that kind of stood out because I feel like with under 20s, you can kind of go down the rabbit hole of X player came out of X school, he won this senior cup, and this is the guy to look out for. But like, I don't know, just like it's in some ways, it's a weird team because you look at Finn Tracy and Jack Murphy, who you mentioned, they're both out of Bray, which is not a very established rugby school. And Tracy, there was some question marks about him from those who'd watched schools rugby, question whether, he was deserving of a starting spot. I think even that question lingered up until this weekend until played really well. Top Ben O'Connor at fullback, you can see why Munster rated him so highly. Yeah, he's not perfect. Like it's under 20s rugby, no one is, but there is the physical components there and there's a brain there.
Well, he had a really nice. I think it was another one of Murphy's passes where he passes it out to Ben O'Connor, draws the
Yeah.
final wing, and then just throws in a one-handed offload. Yeah,
Yeah.
he was another one to mention. He had a pretty good game too.
Yeah, and like with someone like Mike Prendergast coaching him, it's very exciting as a Munster fan. I thought Evan O'Connell, he's probably been skipped over. Maybe it's because he's in his second year, but like I think if a second row is standing out at this level and they're captain and they just look head and shoulders one of the best players in the field, it's something to say for because there's a lot of talk about Junior Kapoku, brother, I think he's brother of Joe Kapoku, if I'm right. In the English second row, I thought Evan O'Connell was fantastic. I think he two line out steals, he was brilliant on the ground. Again, another one. And I thought Joe Hopes was really good as well at number six. And that's to go alongside the guys that you mentioned, the likes of Hugh Gavin, who's been mentioned. Thought Luke Murphy stepped up in a big way in this game. I thought Danny Sheehan stepped up in a big way in this game. And like someone mentioned it last year, I think it could be Bernard Jackman or someone. Like the physical dominance of these Irish sides at under 20 level, like just purely on physical attributes, is something we've never seen before. And it's a sign that I think across the board, the IFU have got it right in terms of conditioning of players at 18, 19, fresh out of school, sub-academy or NTS or PTS guys, as they're called. They've got it right this time, and it's working, and it's really, really impressive. And there's still a championship there for them as well. And the only difference is they're going to hang on about a half an hour, 3/4 of an hour to see if they'll have done enough. It's just hammer Scotland and hope for the best. I know that France, I don't know if he's seen this, and if anyone is still listening to hear this, France have called up some of their top 14 players for this game, for the England game. So if you ever want to talk about France wanting to spoil an English party, they can still win it themselves, but to spoil an English party, well, there you go, because there's a huge opportunity for them to do it there. And I think Hugo Royce, I think someone said, is one of them, the La Rochelle out half, like a lad who's played top 14 rugby for La Rochelle, the best team in Europe, at out half, I think he might be all right. The only difference is maybe they have minus cohesion by the time they take to the field on Friday night, and it'll actually affect Ireland in the long run. But lads, we'll leave it at that. We've had a good hour and a bit talking about the Six Nations. Just one more week to go. Are we going to have two championships? Are we going to have double heartbreak on St. Patrick's weekend? God damn it better not be the second one. I really hope not. Otherwise, I'll still turn up, but I will not be a happy camper next week. But my thanks to Yestin and to David for coming on slightly on short notice with tech issues and rescheduling and all the likes. It happens. It was bound to happen at some stage. So thanks very much, lads. Brilliant contribution as always as well. And as always, we'll be back. Previews, reviews of the round five action before switching our attention to the Women's Six Nations, where we have two feature interviews and one state of the game and one preview podcast to come on the women's game in Ireland. So stay tuned for that. But as always, thanks to everyone at home for listening. Thanks to the lads for their brilliant contributions. If you like what you see or hear, please do subscribe, leave a review, tell a friend. It all makes a huge difference. And I'll have all the links, all the relevant links down below. But for now, until next time, until Thursday.
Sports Social Podcast Network.